the magic and timing that had to occur for me to get my grubby little 18, 19-year-old hands on mine is a story of faded love, petty revenge, and loss. Tune in. Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I got me a little project here to fuss with because I find it's easier for me to remember some of this stuff if my hands ain't idle. And here in the Church of Internal Combustion, we refer to that as instinctive stemming. I don't know what I'm doing, but I kind of know what I'm doing. You dig? Now, if you hadn't seen the first episode, I'm not going to make you, but I recommend you go back and watch the first episode, and it'll let you know kind of how this series is going to work, and then I don't have to waste a lot of time every episode breaking it all down for everybody again. Now, before we stumble off too deep into the story behind the El Camino, I want to read some comments from last week's episode. I think that might be a fun segment. It might not be. That's highly possible. We'll see how it goes. I got them here on my phone. I'm just going to read two or three of them. Here we go. From at Brian Patterson 2524. They'd need a team of professional set designers and prop specialists to try and match up workshop years. And I'm still not quite pull it off. You're the true definition of genuine. That's the draw. Man, that's a... that's about as good a compliment as you can ask for, sir. Everything y'all see here, everything in my shop belonged to somebody that I cared about a great deal. Just thermometer right there belonged to Peppo, John Longmire, the original Peppo Longmire. That used to hang outside his shop most of my life up until he passed away. And my dad had it for a little while, and then he gave it to me, and I just can't bear to part with it, so I keep it in here. And yes, that is the correct temperature, because I live in Houston, Texas, the butthole of the world. All right, let's go to the next one here. What we got? Thanks, Jerry. Love the episode. How about one or two stories about the time you and a buddy did something really stupid in a vehicle and almost bought it, like we all have? The good Lord watches over all of us young Tony Stewart and Dale Earnhardt types when we're young, dumb, and invincible. Boy, amen to that. I couldn't agree more with you. I sometimes wonder how I survived adolescence. That's from at David Kirk 6501. Yeah, tune in. Stay tuned, David. This episode, we get into some of that. Me and the El Camino had a lot of fun adventures. I can't tell them all on account of... I just don't know if I can still get in trouble for some of them, but we're going to tell some of them. All right, this is from at MadMadMeeg5141. Your dad and my dad sound like very similar people, except my dad didn't have the money for whatever car he wanted. But the man can fix just about anything, and he'll tinker with it until he does. Oh, man, I may have miscommunicated that a little bit. See, Draftsman didn't make very good money at all in the early 80s, especially in small town Kilgore. My dad and my mom were just paycheck to paycheck most of my life until things got better for him later on. But he didn't have the money. That Charger, that beat to death Charger, was all he could afford to drag up and put back together so he'd have him a car to go back and forth to work. I was just saying that because he didn't have a job where he had to tote tools around and stuff, he didn't have to have a pickup truck like most of my friends' dads. And I did most of my life. Man, that was fun. I think we'll keep doing that. Let's get off into it, man. This is one of my favorite cars I ever owned in my life. I'm excited to talk about this. I'm excited to tell some of these stories and reminisce about some people I loved. The car we're talking about today is a 1978 El Camino Black Knight Edition. Now, the crazy thing about the Black Knight Edition is they had to halt production on it mid-1978 because Marvel Comics had a character named Black Knight, and they owned all the rights to it. And they went after GM in force and got themselves a fat check, and GM ended up having to change the name to the Royal Knight El Camino. The other thing you should probably take into mind on this is that... ooh, it's hot out here. Back then, when they had these special packages, the Black Knight Edition was mostly aesthetic. It wasn't an engine package. It wasn't high performance or anything like that. It was just aesthetic. It had some stickers on the side and sticker on the hood. But it also had this really cool knight emblem that looked like a knight's head set into the grill like a hood ornament. And that was it. That was it. That was the Black Knight Edition El Camino. It was just some stickers and a mildly different grill. And whether, see, what happened back then is when GM or Ford or anybody would come out with a special option package like that. Some of you might remember Ford did it with the Bigfoot trucks. What would happen is all the little dealerships around the country would go, well, we can't get any of those, and we want to sell some of those. Everybody's asking us for one. So they would go and buy the stickers, and they would make their own. So whether my El Camino was an actual Black Knight Edition El Camino, brother, I ain't got a clue, you know. And I didn't even find out about the Black Knight stuff until after I'd gotten rid of it. So really, it's just something not to worry about. But it did at one point have all that. By the time I got it, somebody had peeled all the stickers off because they were going to paint it. And every time it got wet or you washed it, you could see where all the stickers were, which was kind of hilarious, too. It was almost like a ghost image. Now, El Caminos, El Camino, the Ranchero, every Ute that's ever been made owes itself to a farmer's wife in Australia in 1932 who wrote a letter to Ford Australia, back when you could just do such a thing, write a letter and somebody would read it. She wrote this letter and she said, "Sir, we really need us a vehicle that we can drive to church on Sunday, but also haul our pigs to market in." And Australia Ford had this real cool designer named Lou Brandt, and you should definitely go search Lou Brandt and read about Lou Brandt. He is the father of the Ute. He designed this thing. He cooked this thing up in his head. He had some ideas. He went to town on it. And by 1934, Ford unveiled the 1934 Coupe Utility. Roadster, maybe? I may be wrong about that. They dropped that thing on the market. It went crazy in Australia, right? It did so good in Australia that Studebaker and GM's Holden division made their own coupe utilities like within 2 years of that one and put them out in Australia. Now, it didn't really take off here in America at all, but it went gangbusters in Australia. It didn't take off here at all. In fact, the first time that Henry Ford saw the American version of the coupe utility, he called it a kangaroo chaser, which, knowing Henry Ford's background and colorful history, let's just be thankful that nickname wasn't more problematic, right? But yeah, they didn't take off here. They didn't take off worth a flip here. But Australia went crazy with them, man. Let me tell you, I can remember sometime in the early 2000s, stumbling onto Australian Craigslist and finding out that I'd never even heard of a Ute. I didn't know what a Ute was. I knew what a El Camino was and a Ranchero was. I didn't know what a Ute was. And I stumbled onto Australian Craigslist and thought I'd died and gone to heaven because these people had done made an El Camino out of everything. And they've been making them the whole time. I mean, they had a Ford Falcon El Camino, which Ford Falcon is one of my favorite cars ever made. And I didn't know they even kept making them over there. They even had a Mercedes. A freaking Mercedes El Camino. Boy, I had never seen nothing like that. I'm sure at this point that somebody over in Australia at least once has made a Dodge Viper Ute. Dodge Viper El Camino. It's a Dodge Viper what can haul a whole pallet of Vegemite. That's stupid. But I bet it exists. I know some of the Chevy guys are like, "Man, you sure have done a lot of talking about Ford in a episode about an El Camino," but I love El Caminos. But the fact of the matter is, in the 60s, Ford was almost always first to market with the next big thing. Now, don't get all worked up and run to the comments to tell me what a Chevy hater or a Ford lover I am. You know, just listen a minute. If you don't understand that every manufacturer has had pigs and show horses in different years, then I can't have a car conversation with you. If I hear Chevy sucks or Ford sucks or whatever, anything like that, my brain just turns off to the conversation. I may nod politely and smile whenever you say something until you run out of gas, but I'm most likely thinking about my next meal at that point. The ridiculous thing, honestly, about Ford beating GM to the punch in the 50s with the utility cars is that GM CEO 2 years prior in like 1954 or 1955 had told everybody at GM they needed to be making a utility coupe, and they all laughed at him and told him he was crazy. And this dude, man, his name was Harley Earl. And definitely read about Harley. I could talk about Harley Earl for like 2 hours, right? That's a real name, first off. And definitely a car guy. His dad was a coach builder back when they would basically just build the engines of cars and the drivetrain and the chassis and all that. And then they'd send it to a coach builder and let them build the body for it. And that's what his old man did. That's where he learned how to design cars, was in that coach building shop. And he was like one of the first guys to use models and stuff, like build little foam models and clay models to design these things. And when the guys at Cadillac ran across him, they decided to hire him right there on the spot and bring him in as a designer. This dude did so much. He is such a catalyst in the history of GM and automobiles, period. This guy invented the concept car marketing, basically. Man, he did. He's got a laundry list of stuff he changed about the industry. You know, he's responsible for the Corvette. He had this thing called Project Opel, and he was responsible for what eventually became the Corvette. He was a car dude. He was cool, man. He was the first designer to ever be a VP at GM too. And he told him, he said, man, we need to build this thing. And they said, no, they ain't going to do it. And then Ford, 1957, dropped the Ranchero, and everybody in the United States went nuts for the Ranchero because that was just the kind of thing people was looking for. Not everybody wanted a big old pickup truck. And Harley Earl and his boys got to work. And Harley Earl was a style man. So when the El Camino dropped in 1959, the styling between it and the Ranchero was so different, it's not even funny. You know, the El Camino was gorgeous. And he had went all out on the interior. He'd made a fine-looking machine. So good, in fact, that I think by 1968, it was outselling the Ranchero like 3-1. And by the mid-70s, Ford was talking about quitting on the Ranchero, and the El Camino was still reigning supreme. Now, none of that really has anything to do with my El Camino. But, like I said, if you're going to talk about El Caminos, you got to talk about Australia and where it all begun. My El Camino belonged to my Papaw Clark first. And my Papaw Clark is the one that owned the wrecking yard. Papaw Clark was a big old man, right? And he had a thing about him, right? He was a rounder, dude. He liked to fight and drink beer, and, you know, raise a little hell and race cars and all kind of. He'd been king of the boat club and, you know, this and that. And he was a tough dude, but he was a big old man, big old barrel-chested man. And he worked at E-Tex Welding during the day, selling welding supplies. So he always had him an E-Tex Welding shirt on, big old blue work shirt. And he's unbuttoned right here, and he had him a big old gold chain. And then he always had them sleeves shucked up right here. And he always had big old gold pinky ring on his finger and his wedding ring. And boy, he was just tough as nails. He always wore them welding caps. You remember them welding caps? I mean, I see the kid welders wearing them now, but it's not like the ones I used to make back then. Them welding caps back then, they had all kind of little silly flowers and stuff on them. He always had one of them little welding caps on, I think, every day of his life. And in one pocket, he always had him about $1,000 or so in a gold Avon money clip. And in the other pocket, he carried a nickel-plated, pearl-handled 44 revolver. His little bitty old snub nose. And he always told me that was his equalizer in case things got out of hand. Now, I never seen him pull it on nobody, but I sure heard some stories about him, and I reckon he probably did a time or two. He was a tough, but my Papa Clark, boy, he was something. He could tune an engine by ear. Real, like the real, like there's a lot of people say they can. This old boy would sit down with a 352 Ford and play with that distributor for about 2 minutes, have that thing humming like a sewing machine. He was real good at it. He was a bit eccentric in the things he collected. and the things he kept in his junkyard, but he had a love for El Caminos like no other. He had several that I can remember. He had a light blue one, and I think he had an old red one at one time. But when he got that black one, that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. That was the newest car I'd ever seen him drive, first off. And that black El Camino looked sharp, boy, first time he pulled that thing in the driveway. I used to love riding in it with him. He put the, back then, I think the country station, he put the country station on. We'd listen to Tanya Tucker and Patti Loveless all the way to Lake Tyler on that thing. He'd get us a cold drink. And I got a lot of great memories hanging out with him in that car. And eventually something went wrong with it. We found out the motor broke in it. And being the true old junkyard man he is, he just went and got one of his other El Caminos and started driving it. And I think that one was like a powder blue 79 that somebody had put a 350 in. And it was a pretty clean car, too. The way I got the car is kind of funny because I was about 18 years old. I just graduated high school, and I had a little Dodge Dakota, a little 91 Dodge Dakota with a four banger and a five speed in it. And literally on my way to graduation, I chucked pieces of that five speed Dakota transmission all over A-Leaf Clothing, being stupid. And didn't know what to do. Ended up having to walk to my high school graduation the rest of the way to school. Being kind of embarrassed. All my friends had their cars. Mine was sitting at a gas station with transmission all over the road. But we didn't have a lot of money back then, so I knew it was probably going to be a while before I could get it fixed. I had a little job at AutoZone, but you know how high school jobs are. They don't really pay too much. After you pay for your insurance and your gas, you got just enough to take your girl out on a Saturday night for about 10 minutes and hope she don't want nothing. So right about the time I blew that Dakota up, my papaw had to come down to Houston, down to the heart center, so they could put a heart valve. He had had some heart trouble in the past. He'd had a heart attack or two. What I didn't know about this time period is when he come down to get that heart valve, him and my grandmother had split up. They had separated. They'd been fussing and fighting, and you know, he was running around, and you know, whatever they called him back then, that's what he was doing. A little philandering here and there. So I'm sure she got tired of it or something. She wasn't no prize either. My granny's the most manipulative, crazy woman you ever met in your life. She's a little Irish witch that stands about this tall and has the attitude of a 6'5" demon. So who knows what really happened between the two of them. But boy, she was a schemer. She was always scheming on getting her hands on some money. She liked to go down to them boats in Shreveport, go gambling. She wasn't very good at it because she lost all her money doing that. So he's down there in the hospital. He's getting his heart valve placement. Granny's hanging out at the house. And she said, "Your dad says you need a car. I'd be willing to sell you one of your papaw's El Caminos." And I was like, boy, I was overjoyed. I had no idea papaw even wanted to sell one of them El Caminos. You know, he was pretty particular about them, you know. So I was like, man, you know what? I'll take one of those El Caminos. Daddy just gave me $500 for that Dodge Dakota because he said he wants to keep it and make a little run around town pickup out of it. And Granny said, well, convenient enough. $500 is exactly what I want for that El Camino. And I was too dumb to know at the time I was getting played, but I was sure getting played. So I told Granny, I said, yeah, we got a deal. I can't wait to buy the El Camino, and I'll come up, and when Papaw comes home, I'll come up to Kilgore, we'll get that thing running and see how it's going to do. I was overjoyed. So a couple nights later, I go up to the hospital to see my Papaw. And he's recovering from his heart surgery, and I was just overjoyed to talk to him. I said, "Papaw, you ain't going to believe this. I'm about to get an El Camino. It's one of your El Caminos." And he said, "What the?" He almost come out of that bed. You know what I mean? Big son 50 sat bolt upright in that bed. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, Granny said she'd sell me your old black El Camino for $500. Boy, the string of words, I ain't going to repeat them here. But he said some stuff, bro. That black-hearted, red-headed heifer She ain't gonna sell nothing that belongs to him. You understand me? He's mad as hell. That woman don't own that car. It ain't her car to sell. If you want that car, boy, I'll just give it to you. Right? Well, now all I heard is I'll give it to you. Because now I know I got $500 and a free car to spend it on. Boy, he was hot. He had my dad. He told my daddy where the titles was so we could go get the title, switch the title over in my name. And me and my daddy went up to Kilgore and we drug it over to my Uncle Larry's house because my Uncle Larry's best mechanic I ever known in my life. My dad was a great wrench, great mechanic. My Uncle Larry, he's basically who Uncle and Shop Talk's based off of. My Uncle Larry could fix anything. You never saw him do anything, but he could fix it all, and he did all the time. He was an absolute magician. And probably what's left of the family, probably his middle son, Shane, is the closest thing to him now. Shane's one of the best mechanics I've ever met in my life. He's pretty damn sharp. That boy can figure just about anything out. So we drug it over to Uncle Larry's house and started tearing down the engine. It had a 305 in it, which ain't nothing special, but it's good enough for a V8. I think they run about 170, 200 horsepower, somewhere in there. I couldn't tell you what mine did when we got done with it. I know when we got it open, it had cracked pistons. It had two cracked pistons. And I had to run over to the TRW shop in Longview and get some pistons for it. And I think we bought new wrist pins for it. We used the old rods. But my dad did one of those Jerry Longmire Sr. special works on the heads, bro. He opened them heads up. Man, he opened them heads up, made them flow like the Sabine River after a flood. You know what I mean? Like, these things opened up. So, who knows? It may have been pushing 205 horsepower. Who knows when we got done. But it was a hot-sounding little motor. Sounded good, you know? It ran good. My dad could tune with the best of them. We put a four-barrel Edelbrock carburetor on it, and I bought a Edelbrock intake for it. And my old man tuned that carburetor, had it just top-notch. Man, that car, you mash that gas, had the manual secondaries. Boy, there ain't no hesitation, son. You mash that gas, open up and let her go. That thing was a fun car to drive. Had old highway gears in it, like 278s, you know. And so it felt like it'd run 200 miles an hour, but it'd take about 6 days to get there. But boy, you couldn't have told me that thing wasn't fast. I know it wasn't fast now because, you know, I just know, but you couldn't have told me back then that thing wasn't fast, bro. I thought that was the best car I'd ever been in, son. We got that thing all fixed up and brought it back to Houston. And I still worked at the AutoZone there. And, it was kind of a tumultuous time for me because I just graduated high school and I didn't know really what I wanted to do yet. I didn't have a clue, you know. I knew I didn't want to work in the oil field, or at least I thought I didn't. And I thought I wanted to do something with cars, but I wasn't sure about how to start or go about that. I really wanted to be a mechanic somewhere, even though I didn't know my ass from a hole in the ground. And mostly what I was doing was just running around with my buddies and spending my AutoZone money on gasoline. And you could have told me that thing wasn't fast. Well, I used to take it down to Westheimer every Friday and Saturday night and promptly get my ass handed to me by every car with a mid-grade tune. And it still didn't stop me from believing I had the fastest car around. 100% delusional on that one. I mean, I saw my first punk rock show. Oh, this is great. I saw my first punk rock show in that car. I had never heard of punk rock up until that point. I mean, I knew some popular music and stuff, but I mostly just listened to country music, like my friends, or if I was with my dad, like old classic rock, and my mom would listen to oldies. I didn't know. Nobody had told me about punk rock. Nobody told me that there was this magical place you could go and see a music you'd never knew existed yet. And my friends Steve, Mike, and Alex talked me into one night driving us all down to a place kind of close to downtown Houston off Steubmont called Fitzgerald's. And Fitzgerald's was this, it was just the building probably should have been condemned back then. I think they eventually did. I know it's a parking lot now. But Fitzgerald's was just this old giant house on a gravel parking lot, kind of on the corner of Studemont and White Oak, I think was the name of the street. Right off I-10, and that's where all the punk shows were. That's where all the punk bands played, and we drove down there, and we paid our little money to get in, and I realized immediately on entering the place that I was not a punk rocker because I was dressed completely wrong. I had on a nice button-up shirt and jeans, cowboy boots, and a cowboy hat. Nobody else in there looked like that. I will tell you this. The first time I heard that music, I was enraptured. I didn't know why everybody was angry, but I knew I was struggling with things, and I was angry too, and I just liked it. I was in this room full of angry people listening to some angry music, and the band was called 30 Foot Fall. They were doing a cover of a Cure song, and it was one of the most amazing. Their guitarist, who sadly since has passed on, just was killing it, bro. It sounded so, it was one of the coolest things I'd ever heard. I was just enraptured. I couldn't help it. Next thing you knew, I found myself down off in the pit, you know, moshing or whatever they call it with the guys. And everybody was mostly just elbows and humbucking back and forth and a lot of bouncing off each other. And it was fun. You were blowing some steam off. And I was waving my cowboy hat and having a good old time listening to this punk rock music. And this one little old fella, I guess he didn't care for me. He didn't care for the fact I was wearing a cowboy hat at the punk rock club or the cowboy boots. Who knows what set him off. But he come up and he kicked me off in the back of the knee about 3 or 4 times. And by that point in my life, I had been a short, chubby kid, had been bullied a lot, and was done with that. That was kind of the mean part of my life, where I had had it with bullies. And this kid was about my size, but he done kicked me in the back of the knee about 2 or 3 times. So I turned around and whopped the piss out of him. Just gave him everything I had and the most untrained punch you could ever imagine. Just right in the side of the face. Whop! I think I hit him more with my thumb than I did anything else. But he didn't have much of a constitution because he hit the ground pretty quick. He went down, stumbled, fell all over himself. And it was at that point that me, Steve, Mike, and Alex realized the only friends we had in that place was us. Because all of a sudden, all the big... See, most of these guys down the pit, most of these guys at this concert, it just explained to you, they were like maybe 16, 17 years old, but little rakes, right? These guys are 5'5", 100 pounds soaking wet, little underfed, you know, punk rock kids, basically. But all the big dudes are on the wall, you know, and they start coming off the wall, coming towards us. And that was a, you know, pretty good indication it might be time to go. Now, at the time, my buddy Mike had just come out of Navy boot camp, and boy, he was just itching to hit something different than him. And Mike went to swinging and punching and making his way for the door. Mike was a pretty stout old boy. He was doing some damage. Now, me and Alex, we were the artists of the bunch. We were a little less confrontational than the rest of them. So all we could think about was how to get the hell back to that El Camino. And we started making our way to the door and shoving people off of us. And it's not a far trip from the dance floor to the door. And once we got to the door, we felt like we was in the clear. We started boogieing across that gravel parking lot for the El Camino. I don't know if you ever tried to run across a sharp gravel parking lot in a pair of slippery cowboy boots, but it might be the silliest thing you ever do in your life. I don't know how many times I ate it on the way to that car, but I know it was more than twice. We got back to that car. And I jumped in and fired that booger up. And here come Alex. He jumps in the back of the El Camino. And here comes old Mike Wayne. And Mike Wayne jumps in the side door of the El Camino. And then we see Steve and all his glory. And Steve was a New Mexican. Did I get that right? Yeah. A New Mexican. And Steve was built like a tank. He'd been roofing with his daddy since he was 8 years old, hauling roof bundles and stuff up a ladder. He had some shoulders on him that you could barely fit into El Camino on a good day. And that boy was stout, man. And he had long, blonde hair like a woman. It was the craziest thing. He had the most beautiful hair you ever seen in your life. And Steve come out of that bar, and those guys were piling around him, and he was just throwing roundhouses while walking forward like a juggernaut from the comic books. It was the craziest thing. He was just laying them down. Broop, broop, broop. Just putting these little underfed people on the ground. It was the craziest thing. And he runs up, he jumps in the back of the El Camino, and the mob starts coming through the parking lot towards us. And I thought to myself, self, you could stay here and get a butthole stomped in you. Or you could floor it and hope they got enough sense to get out of the way. And boy, if you believe this, that was the option I took. I slapped, mashed on that gas, buddy. I'll just never forget them opening up like the Red Sea was parting, right? It was the craziest thing. They just opened up and made a channel for that car. And I may have hit one or two. Who knows? That's not really important. But what I will tell you is that when we hit Studemont sideways, Bubba. Just them old junkyard. No, they were used bared tires from Kilgore. Them old used tires was slinging rubber like I was opening a condom factory, buddy. I mean, we were howling, dude. We got that thing on I-10. I didn't let off of gas until we were almost all the way back home, like on West Park off Highway 6. And when I did let off the gas, when we turned on to West Park, I did let off the gas, we could hear this big clunking noise up on the front left part of the car. So I felt like we were safe at that point. We pulled the car over and we started messing around to see what's going on with the car. And my front left wheel was leaning in like one of those little samurai go-karts on freaking Fast and Furious, you know. It was way too much camber, you know. So we didn't know what to do, so we put Steve and Mike in the back right corner of the El Camino, and we had Alex sit on the right front corner of the hood, and then I rolled about 20 miles an hour down West Park till we were able to get that thing limped home. And I'll never forget, the next morning I got out there to jack it up, see what all had gone wrong with it, and my old man come out there and he's looking at that wheel and I'm taking it off and it's just rattling, and he said, hey, that thing making noise? I was like, well, how would I know? I had the radio turned up. And he just shook his head. He said, it made a noise. Buddy, when we got that wheel off that spindle, the only thing holding that hub onto that spindle, the spindle had been machined down to something that looked like it ought to be bore at home in a Renaissance festival. But when we got that hub off, the only thing holding that hub off was like, just the littlest piece of Baron Race and a flat washer and the world's last great cotter pin. That cotter pin was hanging on like a flea on a dog. That thing saved my life, probably. Woo, we had to go get a spindle from the pick apart, change out that whole corner of the front end. I think I ended up having to replace the daggum disc and everything. I know it ate the caliper. I mean, it just did all kind of damage. You know, you can't push a car that hard. That was probably the first big incident in the El Camino. It wasn't very long after that I ended up moving back to Kilgore. Not because of getting in trouble and A-leave or anything, but I had always wanted to move back home. I never wanted to move to Houston in the first place, and I wanted to be back home around my family and stuff. And so I moved back to Kilgore. I got offered a theater scholarship to Kilgore College by the late, great Dr. Kathy Barber. She had offered me a theater scholarship. She was a friend of my aunt's, and I did UIL theater in high school, and she had seen some of my UIL theater stuff, and she offered me a go of it. And unfortunately, after I got up there and everything, and AutoZone transferred me to the AutoZone in Kilgore, and I think I got fired pretty quick. I can't remember. I know I didn't last long there. But she had offered me the scholarship, tried to help me out, and I didn't end up going to college because nobody had told me at that time about student loans and how to make all that work, and all I could see was how much money they wanted and how much money I had, and I didn't think I had enough to do it, and honestly, high school had already been busting my ass a little bit, so I started just chasing skirts mostly and, you know, working whatever little old job I had at the time. And I didn't know what to do with the skirts when I caught them. I was still kind of a Pentecostal boy at the time, you know, so I wouldn't have had a clue what to do if I'd ever caught any of them at that time point, but I was sure chasing them. My best buddy in Kilgore was a fella named Tommy LaBeouf. And Tommy LaBeouf was one of the biggest men I've ever known in my life, and he was that big when he was 17 and 18 years old. I mean, big boy. If you saw Tommy LaBeouf darken your doorway, you'd be hollering at your wife, "Baby, grab my pistol." Right? Like, you wouldn't want to see this guy come in your door until you saw his face, because he had the face of a cherub. Like, I think if you looked up in the dictionary the word Bubba, there ought to have been a picture of Tommy LaBeouf from that time period, because he just had, he always had a smile on his face. His face built like a cherub. He had long, curly blonde hair, and he wore overalls all the time because he couldn't hardly find clothes to fit him. He was a big man. I mean, he was a little heavy, but just a big man, you know, all around. And me and Tommy were the best of buddies, and we were wild. I mean, Pentecostal wild, you know what I mean? Like, we certainly weren't doing drugs and none of that kind of nonsense. We were just mostly, you know, driving too fast. And I think at that time period, I'd maybe had a beer or two or a whole beer once, but nothing too wild. We weren't doing a bunch of drinking and stuff like that. I think the most dangerous thing I ever did was smoke a cigarette and drive too fast at that point. But that was pretty wild for the church, buddy. You couldn't go to the racetrack on Saturday night, hang out at Lone Star Speedway, and then be in the pew Sunday morning without somebody saying something about it, you know. So I guess we were the wild kids. And we were kind of the strays. My Uncle Larry and Barbara always took in the strays, and so they, of course, took us in, and we hung out at their place all the time, and with my cousin Shane, his wife now, Julie. We all spent a lot of time together. And in fact, one of those times, you know, I've said this already, but at that time, I thought I was God's gift to mechanic work. I thought I knew how to do everything my dad did, like I inherited it by osmosis. But I didn't have any of the skill hours or the training to back it up yet. Mostly what I did was just tear shit up, you know. And mostly what I did was just tear stuff up. And I decided El Camino wasn't loud enough, my taste. And I went over to a little old junkyard there off 259, kind of close to where the Rio was in Longview. And I found me a set of headers on another El Camino, believe it or not. That's back when you'd go to a wrecking yard and just find something like that, you know. You'd be hard-pressed to do it these days, but it was a lot more common back in those days. Especially back in East Texas. And so I put them headers on that El Camino and got them all sealed up good. And then I went to the AutoZone exhaust aisle. Boy, I must have spent $200 on clamps and pipe and flex pipe and collectors and tailpipes and what have you. Well, that's back when AutoZone had an exhaust aisle. I don't even know if they got that aisle anymore. I bet if you go to the AutoZone exhaust aisle now, it's just a bunch of stickers of exhaust. Well, you're not. That's mean. I did like working with them people. Yeah, I spent all that money. I brought all that exhaust stuff home. I laid out there in the dirt, jacked that El Camino up. And, buddy, I built what I thought was the world's greatest exhaust system. Let me tell you, it was 2-inch all the way out. I reduced it 2.5-inch pipe. But then it wouldn't fit up in the frame. So I thought, well, hell, I'll just run it under the frame. It ain't like I'm off-roading or anything. And I run that straight pipes all the way out the back of the El Camino. 2-inch straight pipes into 2-inch cherry bombs into 2-inch drag tips sticking out the back. Boy, it sounded, that thing, boy, you could hear it. It set a car alarm off from 2 parking lots away. That thing sounded good to me, buddy. And you look up under that car, I bet I caused a supply shortage with all the clamps I had on that exhaust system. It had so much muffler putty on it, it looked like a redneck pinata. Woo, boy, I was proud of that. You know, one of the great benefits of aging is you get to look back and realize how stupid you were at any point in time. And that's just a super nifty reward to getting older, let me tell you. Yeah, boy, I had that thing muffler puttied up, buddy. I thought that muffler putty was going to hold it all together. And every time I'd hear a little ticking or find a little leak, I'd just smear some more muffler putty on it, buddy. Whew. Me and Tommy one day was hanging out with my cousins. They was going to go over and visit some family over in Shreveport. They said, why don't y'all tag along? I said, heck, we'll do it. We'll fill up $25 worth of gas at El Camino. get us some cold drinks and ice, and we'll go over to Shreveport and have us a good old time with some family and stuff. So we went over there, boy, we had us a time, man. We had a good time that night. The next day, we was getting ready to come home, and I go to pull out of a gas station in Bossier City, and it's one of them, got that real steep ramp coming down out of it, and I come down off that ramp out of that gas station, and it hung that exhaust system, just ripped the whole thing off from the header back. Blech! Right on the ground. Me and Tommy had to get out there and pick up the pieces of my science project and throw it in the back of the El Camino. Woo! That baby was loud then. Open-headed, baby. Shreveport to Kilgore, son. And let me tell you, this is funny. They was working on I-20 at the time. They had I-20 under construction on both sides. They was adding a lane onto the highway. And they had these orange barrels all down, and traffic was backed up for like hours, right? They had these barrels all down there. And I just, man, we sitting there in that traffic sweating. We didn't have no air condition, right? We're just sitting there in that traffic sweating. I remember I kept looking over at that lane, and it's like it was calling to me. It's like, look at this perfect, beautiful asphalt here. Ain't nobody even driven on it yet. Wasn't nothing up but some orange barrels. Hadn't seen no police. Why not? When you're just that young and just that dumb to do something like that. And I whipped that El Camino over on that new pavement. And I did for a little while, I was slaloming in between the barrels, and people started honking at me. Thought I might get off too much attention like that. So me and Tommy whipped that thing out on that blacktop, that open blacktop all the way to Texas. And we opened that El Camino up, boy. Open headers. I mean, it's just a 305, but boy, it sure sounded good. I could have so much years hearing other sounds that weren't even real at some point. Boy, we were flying, man. I couldn't tell you how fast we was going. I don't remember, but it felt like we was doing a couple hundred. And I remember we thought we made it scot-free. We got all the way back to the Texas line, and there's a little hill there. And right when we come up over that hill to cross into Texas, there was a Texas state trooper sitting right there with his lights on just waiting for me. And they didn't even have cell phones back then. Like, I still don't know who ratted me out, you know? But he was waiting for me right there. We come off that hill, and I was like, oh, my goose is cooked. I'm done, bro. That state trooper got me out of that El Camino, read me the riot act, son. Boy, and he started writing tickets. It was like he was writing for King James. You know what I mean? He just started putting the whole Bible together and stuff. Reckless driving, yada, yada, an exhibition of acceleration, bad tags, no exhaust system. But he got done, it was a stack of tickets that thick, and I must have looked awful depressed by the time he walked back up to that El Camino. I'm surprised I wasn't in tears at that point. And he come up to that car, and he looked down at me, he said, you know what? Hell, you didn't even do any of that in Texas. And he ripped them tickets up and gave me a ticket for my muffler. And he goes, I suggest that y'all cruise nice and easy and quiet the rest of the way back to Kilgore, and you get this car fixed as soon as you get home, son. And I didn't, but we did. We did make it back to Kilgore. I did eventually paper mache my exhaust all back together and get it back on there. Actually, it wasn't even like a week later. I spent all week putting that exhaust system back on, because me and Tommy was going to go run around Tyler, Texas on a Friday night and, you know, look for girls and whatnot and look for something fun to do. And we was coming back from Tyler, Texas on Highway 31, and I had that thing wound out. We was coming into Kilgore, and a Kilgore City Police, throwed his lights on, went to turn around on Highway 31 after we whipped past him. And back then, I don't know if you can still get on them now, but back then, all over East Texas, they had these oil leases, and that's where all the wellheads and stuff was set up and pump jacks and whatnot. And they had these dirt roads that they would grade from time to time on all these oil leases around the place. And you could get from Highway 31 right there close to, I think it was Bodacious Barbecue, you could get from Highway 31 almost all the way to my granny's house on oil lease roads. You only had to cross over Highway 42 at one little spot and jump on Sexton Road. And I whipped that El Camino off down to those dirt roads. And, buddy, it wasn't nothing. We knew them roads, right? But still, it's not a stable car. It's like driving a Monte Carlo or anything else rear wheel drive in the dirt. And I'm sliding that thing around like Bo Duke. I mean, it ain't nothing. It's like 20 minutes of staring at fast pine trees and sliding on caliche clay. You know what I mean? And we just did it until, like, I couldn't see them Kilgore City lights behind me anymore. Like, once he was far enough back away in the woods, I wasn't worried about him anymore. We were almost to Highway 42, and there was a little rise coming up on the 42, and I couldn't see no headlights coming from either way. And we hit that rise and launched that El Camino up. Woo! We're probably only 3 inches off the ground, but it felt like it's about 8 foot and probably about 60 feet lengthwise, but wasn't nowhere nothing like that. But right when we hit that rise, it went ahead and just ripped that old exhaust system right back off the El Camino. And me and Tommy had to get out again and pick up my art project and put it in the back of the El Camino and try to creep that thing up in my grandma's house late at night with open headers. I think I shut it off about halfway down the dirt road so we could just cruise in the driveway, you know? Yeah. Boy, that car just about kept me in trouble. Let me tell you. I don't think I ever fixed the exhaust system out of that, to be honest with you. I think I just drove that thing around open headers around Kilgore. But the problem is, by that point, I had gotten in trouble enough times with the police in the little area. And when you do that in a small town, you're just setting yourself up for failure because now they know your car. And I couldn't go nowhere to El Camino without having to look over both ways, try to keep from getting a ticket everywhere I went. Because they were just looking to hang paper on me by that point. So my dad offered to sell me. My dad had an S10 that had been wrecked. It actually belonged to Papa too. And my dad had this little wrecked S10. He offered to sell me that S10. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I just need me a little old Papa truck to ride around in and be inconspicuous for a little while. And plus, I just got me a new job as a mechanic, and I needed a way to tote my tools up to the shop. And there's old junker scrapper in town, and I sold him that El Camino for $500 because that's what my daddy wanted for the S10. Every car was $500 back then. You could just buy $500 cars all day long. And I sold it to that scrapper for $500, and he let me take a seat out of a S10 from about the same year model he had over there on his property because my seat was all tore up. So I got a new seat and $500 for that little S10. And, for the El Camino, sorry. Well, daggum, you're just gonna be a bugger, ain't you? It's kind of ironic that I gave up my El Camino for S10 because that's actually what happened to the El Camino. GM released the S10, and the S10 was selling so good, they figured they didn't need the El Camino or need to fulfill that market anymore. So that's why they discontinued the El Camino, actually, because of the S10. Got something not right here. Beautiful. You know, after all that, that guy sold that El Camino to a boy that worked over to Piggly Wiggly. And I used to see it every once in a while when I would go back to town to visit. I'd see that El Camino sitting over there in Piggly Wiggly parking lot. He put some IROC Z wheels on it, and it actually looked pretty hot. And I was like, you know what? I'm glad somebody's got it that loves it and is enjoying it, you know? No sense crying over spilt milk. And, yes, sir. So I was happy with that outcome. After all that, I actually found out what happened to that car, too. And I found out who ended up with that car. Tommy LaBeouf and me reconnected about 2 or 3 years ago. He's seen some of my comedy videos on the internet, and he reached out to me, and we chit-chatted a little bit. And Tommy told me that he ended up buying that El Camino from the kid that worked at the grocery store. And he said, Jerry, I'm telling you the truth when I tell you I drove the wheels off that car. Like, there wasn't hardly much left of the drivetrain by the time they called it in for scrap. And that made me just, that just tickled me to no end to know that my buddy ended up with that car and loved it every much as I did and, you know, got his money's worth out of it. And who knows, man, that thing could have been in a scrapyard crushed by now, or it might be sitting in some other 18-year-old's driveway waiting for its fourth life or its fifth life. Who knows, you know? Maybe somebody's papaw has it now. That would be cool. Either way, I was happy Tommy ended up with it. Tommy, against all odds, turned out to be a Pentecostal preacher up there somewhere in, I think, around Shawnee, Oklahoma. And he's got him a good little congregation, and he works his tail off for them, and they seem to love him. And I got to see him a while back at my Uncle Larry's funeral. He was a good dude. I mean, we don't see eye to eye on a lot of religion stuff, and I've got a lot of misgivings about being raised that way. But a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about religion and spirituality, and that's all fine and good. And I'm not here to tell anybody what the right way or the wrong way is, because about the only thing I figured out at 46 years old is the older I get, less I'm sure about a damn thing. But the one thing I can tell you is I've met a few men that I believe were men of God in my life, and I think Tommy was one of them. He was just as good-hearted and kind of soul as I've ever met, and I'm glad he found his calling and he found a life that works for him and gives him some reward. I'm glad to hear that. Hey, man, I thank you guys for hanging out with me tonight while I tinker about here and mess around. I cannot convey how good it felt to see how good the first episode did. I hope this one does as well. And I plan on keeping making these. If you're enjoying it, hit that like button, hit that subscribe button, jump on the Wainer team. Come be a big Wainer with the rest of us. It's a good time. And if you hadn't seen the first episode yet, go back and watch it. You know, it's got a little less car stuff in it because I had to set it up. And stay tuned. Next week, we're going to talk about a very, very special 1977 Datsun 280Z. I'm JW, and I love you.